everybody, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and our mobile app as well. You might be listening in podcast form, wherever you might be. Glad to be with you. We're looking at the case laws of ancient Israel, and this is just so interesting and intriguing to me. And really, these laws were about putting love in action, and we're going to see some pretty wild sins that people were into at that time, and they unfortunately still are today. Sorcery, seduction, selfish lending practices, all kinds of other faults. And all these things really demonstrate a lack of love that does not go unnoticed by God. It does not go unpunished by God either. And also today, for the first time, we're going to see how God reveals himself to be compassionate. It's the first time in the Bible where this is mentioned, that God is compassionate. But how? So we're going to talk about that. We're going to break it all down. So I want you to open up your Bible, and we'll pick up where we left off, looking at these laws of restitution in ancient Israel. And just kind of to set the big picture for you once again, this is the second part of the book of Exodus, and this is really the presence of God. The first part of the book was the power of God, God extracting the Israelites from Egypt with mighty power. This is forget about a Navy SEAL operation. This was a divine rescue operation like no other. And this is the second part of the book. Now that they're free, they have to learn how to live together and with God. So this is the presence of God, and God is teaching him how his society ought to be. So let's pick it up in chapter 22, verses 5 and 6. Now, these two verses here are about cases of negligence. And sometimes people, when it comes to the law, they're just negligent. It's almost like sins of omission. There's things that they do that are wrong. There's things that they ought to have done that they don't do. And the law, I remember once when I was in university taking a class on law, the professor said, you know, really the law is all about, in some ways, what a reasonable person would do. Now, there's a lot of unreasonable actors and characters out there, but these examples here that we're going to look at are people being unreasonable and just not taking care, being negligent. And it would be negligent of me not to talk about this. So let's look at them. Chapter 22, verses 5 and 6, it says, when a man causes a field or a vineyard to be grazed over, or lets his beast loose, and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best in his own field and in his own vineyard. And it says, when fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that the stacked grain or the standing grain or the field is consumed, he that kindled the fire shall make full restitution. Okay, so obviously we're dealing there with an agrarian society. It still is that case in many places in the world. So what happens if your cow just kind of wanders into your neighbor's field, starts eating from the field? How do you deal with this? How do you repay that? Well, you have to make restitution. Your cattle has maybe walked over his crops and destroyed them or started eating them. It's not right that he should have to suffer. So this is what has to be done, restitution. Now, in verse 6, the subject has changed a little bit to dealing with issues of fire. And sometimes these things take place. Those who live out in the West, those who have dealt with California wildfires, know the incredible destruction that can be wrought by fire. What if it's your fault? What if you have a fire going and it accidentally sets your neighbor's crops on fire? Well, this can take place, and it gives an example of this. He that kindled the fire shall make full restitution, because this is a huge economic loss. You might have lost your crops for a whole season. You can't sell them. You can't eat them yourself. So restitution is the key. Once again, this is all about restitution, the laws of ancient Israel. They didn't have supermax prisons. We talked about this before. This was crime and punishment in ancient Israel. It was the law of restitution. Let's move on now really quickly to verses 7 and following. Just going to read this next little section here. All right. It says, if a man delivers to his neighbor money or goods to keep, this is chapter 22, verses 7 to 13 here. If a man delivers to his neighbor money or goods to keep, and it is stolen out of the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief is not found, the owner of the house shall come near to God to show whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's goods. for every breach of trust, whether it is for ox, for donkey, for sheep, for clothing, or for any kind of lost thing of which one says, this is it, the case of both parties shall come before God. He whom God shall condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. If a man delivers to his neighbor a donkey or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, and it dies or is hurt or is driven away without anyone seeing it, an oath by the Lord shall be between them both to see whether he has put his hand to his neighbor's property, whether he has not put his hand to his neighbor's property, and the owner shall accept the oath, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is torn by beasts, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn. If a man borrows anything of his neighbor, and it is hurt or dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. If the owner was with it, he shall not make restitution. If it was hired, it came for its hire. Now, what on earth is this stuff all about? This is about property belonging to another person, whether you borrow it or not. Okay, so let's look at verses 7 through 9 here. This is all about property that is not living. It's not an animal or anything like that. So it says, if a man delivers to his neighbor money or goods to keep, and it is stolen out of the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. Okay, so for example, you might not have, there weren't safe deposit boxes back then. You couldn't go into a bank and just kind of lock up your valuables. You might say to someone, you might say to a neighbor, listen, I've got to go away for a while. Can you please look after this stuff? This is family jewelry. These are heirlooms. I've got my Wayne Gretzky autographed Edmonton Oilers jersey. You really, really have to keep this in a safe place for me. Okay, sure, I'll do it. But then it disappears. The stuff is gone and it's stolen. Okay, well, if you find the thief, again, the thief has to pay double what this stuff is worth if he's caught. And again, this is what goes on here. If something is stolen, if money is stolen, if stuff is stolen, the general rule in Israel was you have to repay twice the value. So it is a pretty good deterrent if you get caught here. Now, what happens if there is no evidence? All right, let's keep reading here just a little bit. In verse 8, if the thief is not found, the owner of the house shall come near to God to show whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's goods. So what does this mean? Essentially, this might mean that, okay, you give your stuff to this guy to look after, and he says, it's gone. It must have been stolen. Now, there is a slim possibility that the guy could have eBayed all the stuff and just sold it for profit or taken it to a memorabilia show and gotten a top dollar for it. It wasn't really stolen, you know, by someone else. He stole it in a sense, and he has gotten rid of it. Well, how do you prove this? Well, essentially what has to happen is the guy has to swear to God that he didn't steal it. And this is interesting because it says in the text that this person must appear before the God. Now, some Bible translations say that what he has to do is go before the judges of the town. And that's kind of the same thing as swearing to God. You're going before the judges saying, I swear I didn't take this guy's stuff. Someone else stole it. I don't know who or where this stuff is now, but I don't have it. It could be the judges, but it also might mean quite literally must appear before God. The guy has to appear before God himself to swear that he didn't do it. Now, how on earth could he do that? How can you appear before God himself? Well, you take an oath, and it's just like in a courtroom today. You might watch Judge Judy on TV. If you do, you probably should be doing other things with your time, but obviously you've seen courtroom dramas. You've seen people, maybe you've been in court before, maybe you've had to do this, maybe you've been a witness, and maybe you've had to literally put your hand on a Bible and swear to God that you'll tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. And we know that people do, unfortunately, lie in court all the time. Maybe they're thinking, I'm an atheist. I don't believe any of this stuff. I'm going to swear on this Bible, but it doesn't mean anything to me. Well, back then in ancient Israel, when people took an oath before God, it was a much more fearsome prospect. What do I mean by that? Well, they would be in the tabernacle in all likelihood, and especially if you're coming in at night. Let's say you're going to night court here to hearken back to an old TV show. They're redoing a new version of this, by the way. I digress. But let's say you go into the tabernacle. You are swearing before God in terms of the pillar of fire. The pillar of fire is there. It's a sign of God's living presence with Israel on their journey to the promised land. And you know that this pillar of fire is not plugged in. It's not running on lithium-ion batteries. It's not hooked up to a natural gas line. This is a supernatural flame. And you better believe that when you're swearing an oath before the living God, before the pillar of fire, that you're probably doing it with a lump in your throat because you're terrified. So the chances are you're going to be telling the truth. So that may be what's in view here. So determining guilt, determining innocence, it's very much about taking these oaths and swearing before the Lord. And God sees. God knows what's happening here. All right, now let's keep going here. Let's go to chapter 22, verses 10 to 13. Now we go to legal responsibility here, but now the subject shifts from stuff, from money, from goods, to, once again, animals. Because back in the ancient world, people didn't brag about what kind of car they drove. They bragged about how awesome their donkey was or how many oxen they had. And this was necessary for them to do their work, for them to feed themselves and their families. So let's go to verses 10 to 13 here. It says, if a man delivers to his neighbor a donkey or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, and it dies or is hurt or is driven away without anyone seeing it, an oath by the Lord shall be between them both to see whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's property. And the owner shall accept the oath, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is torn by beasts, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn. If a man borrows anything of his neighbor, and it is hurt or dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. If the owner was with it, he shall not make restitution. If it was hired, it came for its hire. Okay, so what's happening here? Once again, somebody might say, hey, listen, I'm going to take a little vacation here. I'm going to do some golfing in Arizona, maybe catch a couple spring training games. Can you please watch my donkey or my ox while I'm away? No problem. I'll take care of it. Unfortunately, it dies. The animal dies while this guy's away, calls his friend on the golf course and says, I've got some bad news for you. Well, what if nobody saw this happen? What if nobody sees how the animal dies and nobody can really prove, did I kill your animal while you were away? That's when another oath is taken here, and the owner of the animal has to just sort of take the guy's word for it. What else can he do? Now, if it is stolen from, let's say your donkey is stolen from your friend, that's your friend's fault because he was supposed to be watching it. He was supposed to be taking care of it. He's allowed a thief to come in. Maybe his home wasn't secure. Maybe he didn't have cameras set up, whatever the case may be. Then he has to pay back, make restitution. If it's torn by wild beasts, not a problem. You're off the hook in that sense. But you have to bring the evidence, as grisly as it might be. You have to bring the carcass of the animal. It's been attacked by wild beasts. Hey, just to prove I didn't kill your animal. It wasn't my fault. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it is hurt or dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. So can I borrow your donkey, please? Can I borrow your oxen? I need to plow my fields. If you're not there watching over the oxen, the oxen dies, maybe he's driving it too hard in the sun. Again, the guy who borrows it has to pay back full restitution. But if, let's say you hire your friend's oxen. Hey, I hear you've got a little bit of time on your hands. Your field's already plowed. Can I pay you to plow my fields? Yeah, sure. I'll bring over my oxen and I'll do it. I'll drive the animal myself and we'll get it done. Well, if the owner is with the animal and the animal drops dead, then you don't have to pay anything because he was there. It was a hired job and it's not your fault. So just like if you were to hire a company to cut your grass and their lawnmower breaks down, they have to pay for the maintenance of that. Okay, so let's keep going here and let's move on here. Okay, let's get to a new section here. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. We're going to look at a new section here on social and religious laws. And some of this stuff is going to be kind of juicy. This is going to be kind of risque stuff, and we need to talk about it. We need to figure out what's going on here. And like I said, for the first time in this section, you're going to hear about how God is compassionate. So let's read this together. Let's pick up the text here. And this is Exodus chapter 22, verses 16 and following, all the way to the end of the chapter, verse 31. It says, "If a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall give the marriage present for her and make her his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equivalent to the marriage present for virgins. You shall not permit a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with a beast shall be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to any god save to the Lord only shall be utterly destroyed. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you do afflict them, and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn. And I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be to him as a creditor, and you shall not exact interest from him. If ever you take your neighbor's garment in pledge, you shall restore it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering, it is his mantle for his body. And what else shall he sleep? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. You shall not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest and from the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do likewise with your oxen and with your sheep. 7 days it shall be with its dam. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. You shall be men consecrated to me. Therefore you shall not eat any flesh that is torn by beasts in the field. You shall cast it to the dogs." Okay, now we will talk much more about some of this stuff in the next episode, but why is it, at the very end there, why is it that if an animal is attacked by wild animals, by other wild animals, you can't then use that animal for food? It's torn by wild beasts, you have to throw it to the dogs. Hey, fantastic for the dogs. They get some choice cuts of meat here, but the reason why it's not fit for consumption is because it cannot be sacrificed to God. It cannot be sacrificed properly, and therefore it just has to be let go. So there are all kinds of interesting social laws here. We're going to get into this a little bit more, but the death penalty comes back here. There are certain laws that are worthy of the death penalty in ancient Israel, and there are three of them here in this section. Sorcery, specifically with reference to sorceresses. The sorceress must die in verse 18. And then there is, unfortunately, a mention of bestiality and also sacrificing to any god other than Yahweh, any god other than the one true and living God. That is also worthy of the death penalty. So those three things we'll talk about. And also the fact that God is compassionate. This is the very first time in the Bible that this is mentioned. And we know that Jesus certainly had compassion on the crowds in the New Testament. He says the crowds are harassed and helpless. They're like sheep without a shepherd. And he had compassion on them. And he taught them and healed them. And so this is the very first passage in the Bible here in Exodus chapter 22 where we hear that God, in fact, is compassionate. Wow. In fact, one scholar says this is so important that this is really the main verse in the whole section here. So how does God's compassion square with the death penalty, meeting out the death penalty? All of that we'll deal with in the next episode. But right now, we have to jump in once again to the Faith Explained Q&A mailbag. Here we go. Okay, as we open up our Q&A mailbag, I want to once again remind you how you can get your question to me, and I'll try to deal with it on the air. You can simply email me. The address is faith@relevantradio.com, faith@relevantradio.com, or you can also try following me on Twitter. Send me a message there. You can tweet at me. My handle is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Okay, so our first question comes to us from Rebecca, who's listening in Dallas. And this is a question that you hear from time to time. It's kind of a liturgical question. Rebecca asks, "Hi, Cale. After receiving communion at Mass, is it permissible to sit, or does one have to kneel after receiving communion?" So, okay, that's an interesting question. It really has to do with the posture of the body after receiving our Lord or Eucharistic Lord. And of course, Catholic worship really does highlight the fact that we are a unity. We are a unity of body and soul, the human person. We worship God in and through the body. St. Paul in Romans 12 talks about being a living sacrifice. And this really comes through in our worship because we do kneel, we do genuflect before the King, Jesus Christ, in the tabernacle. We do take holy water and we bless ourselves with it, really signifying that we belong to God in the totality of our being, body and soul. And of course, it's a reminder of our baptism, how we were brought into the family of God. But when it comes to the liturgy, is there anything in the books that talks about whether or not you must kneel, or is it permissible to pray while seated after receiving communion? Some people even stand, and I'll get into that in just a second, but all of the instructions on how things go in the liturgy, ladies and germs, come from, and I say that it's a really bad pun, but it's called the germ. That's the colloquial way that priests sometimes talk about it and bishops. It's called the General Instruction of the Roman Missal, G-I-R-M. So now, normally germs are bad things, but this germ is a good thing. It tells us really how the liturgy should go. And in number 43 of the germ, it says, "If appropriate, they may sit or kneel during the period of sacred silence after communion." End of quote. Okay, so it seems there from seeing this that, Rebecca, there's an option. There's an option for you. You could kneel and pray after receiving our Lord, or you may choose to sit in your pew. And essentially, you've got the option. You've got the option. Now, the one thing that might override that is if a local bishop, if your local ordinary, your bishop or your archbishop says, "I decree that every single one of the faithful in this archdiocese or in this diocese should or ought to kneel, you know, health permitting, after receiving communion," then you got to obviously take that directive as a precedent. So really what's going on here, though, is your interior disposition is really the key here. Now, some people actually, I've seen this before, and this is pretty wild. And I don't know if you've seen this. It's happened a lot where I live in local parishes where certain priests have told their congregations, and they have no authority to do this, they've told their congregations that they must stand after receiving the Eucharist. They must go back to their pew and stand there until everyone else in the church has received the host. And then, and only then, can they kneel down. And actually, believe it or not, some of these priests have even used the expression, "You must stand until everyone has dined." What? No, I'm sorry. This is just beyond the pale. And sometimes you see people who have gone to these parishes, they show up in other parishes, and they'll start doing this. They'll start standing after they've received the Eucharist, and they will wait until everyone. And you can tell that they've kind of been hanging out in these circles. There is nothing in the liturgical rubrics that says that you have to do this. The priests that are teaching people this, and these poor people who are hearing this and they're abiding by this instruction, this is nowhere in church teaching. Okay, so you don't have to do that by any stretch of the imagination. This whole idea of dining, that's not a good way to refer to receiving our Lord or Eucharistic Lord. You're not at a restaurant here. This has nothing to do with etiquette or anything like that. So you are well within your rights to go and back to your pew, and you can kneel, you can pray seated. Again, your interior disposition is really what's in play here, and that's what you got to pay attention to. Okay, let's go to the next question here and squeeze in one more. Seth in Salt Lake City, Utah writes in and asks, "Hi, Kale, I've got a question for the Faith Explained Q&A mailbag. Why do you see some of the faithful kissing their thumb after they're finished praying? Is that in lieu of them not carrying a rosary where they can kiss the crucifix, etc.?" Okay, yeah, that's a really good question, Seth. And in fact, I was super curious about this myself because you do see this all the time. You see people praying, and before they get up, they will kiss their thumb. Well, what they're really doing there, and I didn't realize this until I did my own research on this recently. What they're doing is, this is a tradition. I'm not sure where it comes from, but they're not pretending that they have a crucifix that they're kissing. And it's very often the case that one of the faithful may carry a small pocket crucifix, and they may kiss it before they begin their work. It's a good habit to get into. Actually, if you have one, you can sort of put it on your desk very discreetly while you're working, or when you get up at the end of the night, kiss the crucifix, kind of unite yourself with Jesus on the cross. Or if you're praying the rosary, very often people will kiss the crucifix as an act of devotion to our Lord when they're done, or maybe even when they begin praying the rosary too. But what they're doing here is interesting, because they're actually making a cross between their thumb and their forefinger. And I used to think people were just kissing their thumbs, but it's actually, they're making a cross, and this is an ancient practice. And if you look at your hand, if you sort of make a fist and look at it, look at your thumb, the thumb would be the vertical beam of the cross, if you will. And if you extend your index finger, it becomes the horizontal beam of the quote-unquote cross, and that's what they're doing. So when they're kissing their thumb, they're essentially making a cross with their thumb and their forefinger, and they are, in a sense, kissing the cross. They're not just kissing their thumb. So mystery solved, I hope. I've often wondered that too, so I'm glad that you asked that question. And no matter how silly your question you might think it is, I guarantee you somebody else has thought this. So why don't you write in your question to me? Once again, the address is faith@relevantradio.com. Again, it is faith@relevantradio.com. And again, I'm your host, Cale Clark. You can always follow me on Twitter at Cale Clark. And I'll see you later today for the Cale Clark Show, live at 5 p.m. Central, right here on Relevant Radio. And in 23 and a half hours, I'll see you on the next Faith Explained tomorrow. So God bless you. Until then, take care. Peace.